From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, December 21st, 2018. And on this day, just before he is about to leave office, Governor Paul LePage's administration has gotten federal permission for work requirements for Medicaid. It's not clear what that might mean, with Janet Mills about to start her term. We'll have that story and more in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, presenting Gardens Aglow, where visitors will see the gardens in a whole new light, now through December 31st. MaineGardens.org.
The federal government has approved Maine's request to require that Medicaid recipients work to receive benefits. Maine's one of about half a dozen states to have approved by the Trump administration. The policy is controversial, and as Patty White reports, its future is not certain in Maine, where a transition in state leadership is underway.
The approval of Maine's waiver to implement work requirements has been a long time coming. The LePage administration submitted its request back in the summer of 2017. A few months later, the Trump administration announced its general support of Medicaid work requirements, but it took nearly a year to grant official approval to Maine. Now, it's come in the waning days of the LePage administration.
We're hopeful that with new leadership coming in, with Governor-elect Mills, who's been a really vocal, I think, supporter of improving access to affordable health coverage, that these proposals will not go forward.
Robin Merrill is executive director of the low-income advocacy group Maine Equal Justice. She says the work requirements are an attempt to undermine the purpose of Medicaid, which is to provide health coverage to low-income individuals who can't access it otherwise.
We need more affordable health care, not less. These proposals would take us in the opposite direction than where we need to go.
Under the waiver, Maine would require able-bodied individuals in the Medicaid program to work or to perform community service for at least 20 hours a week. Recipients would also pay monthly premiums. If recipients fail to meet the work requirements for a total of 3 months within a three-year period, they'll lose benefits. In a written statement, Governor LePage says the work requirement will, quote, help prioritize Maine's neediest populations and preserve the financial stability that's been achieved within the program over the last 8 years. LePage goes on to say that the primary goal of public assistance is to help people, and this policy will encourage them to stand on their own and take charge of their financial independence. But Robin Merrill rejects the idea that the work requirements will actually help people.
They can impose restrictions and limits that will ultimately result in people losing health coverage.
That's what happened in Arkansas, where about 17,000 Medicaid recipients have lost their coverage since the state implemented work requirements in June. An analysis by the Kaiser Family Foundation found that efforts to contact recipients about the new requirements weren't widely successful, raising questions about how many recipients knew about the change. Robin Merrill says Maine Equal Justice will likely challenge Maine's work requirement in court if Governor-elect Janet Mills doesn't terminate the waiver. Mills spokesman Scott Ogden issued a written statement saying Mills will review the waiver when she assumes office. As a general rule, he says, Mills supports training initiatives to put people to work. He notes that the governor-elect prefers incentives rather than mandates, and being healthy is a first step in being eligible for work. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
A group of migrant workers from Latin America is raising allegations of sexual harassment by a labor contractor for the Worcester Wreath Company, the company associated with the popular Wreaths for Across America effort. 8 workers, 4 women and 4 men, reported being fired after complaining about the harassment, and as Susan Sharon reports, a pair of investigations are now underway.
Richard Rivera O'Neill of Puerto Rico said he witnessed sexual harassment the first week the women arrived in Harrington, Maine to work for the Worcester Wreath Company. Between October and December, the peak of the season, as many as 800 workers, mostly from Latin America and the Caribbean, are hired by the company and its contractors. Many of the wreaths are made for the company's nonprofit affiliate, Wreaths Across America, and placed on veterans' graves before Christmas. O'Neill said the problem started after the women wound up being housed in a room with men. Speaking through an interpreter, he says a contractor began stopping by and repeatedly asking them to have sex with him.
When the woman confronted him and told him that they weren't that kind of woman, he still insinuated and asked them to have sex with them. And at that point, it was getting hard to handle, but a lot of them wouldn't speak up because of fear of losing their job.
Neither O'Neill nor Mano and Mano, an advocacy group that helps migrant and farm workers in Washington County, is naming the contractor. An attorney for the workers also declined to provide his name. O'Neill says after he and several men joined the women in protesting their treatment, they were fired and kicked out of their housing. But Tim Woodcock, an attorney for the Worcester Wreath Company, says the workers were terminated by the labor contractor for what he calls serious misconduct. And Woodcock says they were offered an alternative.
The workers came to Worcester and said that they thought they hadn't been treated fairly, so Worcester did offer them direct employment and offered them relocation to housing elsewhere so that they would be nowhere near the contractor in question, but they declined both offers.
Woodcock says the company takes the allegations seriously and will put together a team to investigate their validity. In a written statement, the company says it is not currently working with the contractor who is the subject of the allegations. If the allegations are verified, Worcester says it will take swift action to address misconduct. Andrew Schmidt, a Portland attorney who is representing the workers, says he is also conducting an investigation on their behalf. One of the women, Waleska Alicia Rodriguez, said in a written statement that the abuse against women must stop. They think immigrant workers won't do anything or speak up, she said. I am not afraid. I am raising my voice so that other women don't have to go through this.
This is not the first time we've seen this. I think this is the first time that a group of workers is collectively taking action.
Christina Ocampo of Mano & Mano says her group has previously supported individual workers who've complained of wage theft, sexual harassment, and other exploitation. And she says the workers' goal is to hold their labor contractors accountable for the injustices taking place under their roof. A spokesperson for the Maine Department of Labor says the workers made a complaint to her agency, but she says the allegations are not within DOL's jurisdiction and should be raised with the Maine Human Rights Commission instead. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Susan Sharon.
This year, about 95 million households across the country will put up a Christmas tree, and about 80% of those trees will be artificial. Christmas tree growers in Maine and across the U.S. have seen their markets for live trees melting away for at least two generations. They've tried to turn the trend around, but as Jennifer Mitchell reports, the industry is divided over how to grow demand.
That tree should have a price tag on it.
42.
Oh, okay. 42.
Jim Horan of Dixmont is buying a 6-foot balsam fir and 3 wreaths at Piper Mountain Christmas Trees in the little farming community of Newburgh, Maine.
77.54.
The artificial trees don't appeal to me at all. If that was the only choice, I doubt it would have a tree.
But Horan is part of a shrinking group of real tree buyers. And that's something the man he's buying the tree from, Jim Corliss, has been watching firsthand for decades. Corliss planted his first trees at Piper Mountain 50 years ago.
Thank you. Thank you very much. The real Christmas tree had about 95% of the Christmas tree market in this country. And it was about 35 million trees.
These days, between 20 and 30 million such trees are sold each year, which at first might look like only a modest dip in sales. But the figure doesn't take into account the population growth that happened when the baby boom generation started having its own kids. As the country's population surged, Corliss says the unorganized tree industry seemed to be unaware that retailers were busy marketing the ease and convenience of artificial trees to busy families.
In our search for the perfect Christmas tree, we went back to the forest to see an original and duplicated it.
With color-coded branches, it snaps together, 1, 2, 3, and it comes with a 10-year guarantee.
Est-ce le feuillage exclusif True Needle, inspiré des branches de sapin?
As an industry, we failed to realize just because we were selling the same number of trees, we were going downhill as far as market share was concerned. That trend has continued to the present day at the rate of 1 to 1.5% per year.
But 3 years ago, tree growers got together and decided to launch an organized marketing effort by signing on with the USDA Agricultural Marketing Program. It assesses a mandatory fee from each producer of a commodity and then invests the fee money in research and marketing on the industry's behalf. You've likely seen some of their work already.
The incredible edible egg.
Got milk.
Growers, hopeful that some similar branding push could be done for their industries, came out 70% in favor of signing on to the program. So for the last 3 years, the pilot marketing effort has been in effect, raising about $2 million annually. But support seems to have eroded. This year, a required assessment vote on whether to continue with the program on a longer-term basis garnered just 51% in favor, highlighting a very divided industry. One reason behind the dimming enthusiasm, opponents say, is that there's no program. Anyone in the U.S. who produces at least 500 Christmas trees for sale, whether they call themselves a tree farmer or not, must pay 15 cents per tree to the program.
I mean, 10,000 trees, you're looking at $1,500. Yeah, it definitely eats into the margin.
Tammy Mulvey of Pleasant View Tree Farm in Hodgdon says she was initially in favor of the marketing program, but she says it's too painful to write a big check at the end of a season, especially when she feels that her rural business has not seen a corresponding benefit.
They've got some nice videos out there, and they've got some advertising stuff going on. And I guess in bigger cities, they do more TV ads and things of that sort. But I don't believe, you know, I know there's none running in my area. We didn't see any real difference, so we voted against it.
Grower Jim Corliss acknowledges that things won't change overnight, but he says he's exasperated by the industry's inability to get together and stick to a plan. He says voluntary participation schemes have failed in the past, and he's frustrated by what he sees as a lack of support from Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue. The industry is being given another chance to decide on whether to stay with the USDA marketing program or not. Because of the slim margin of this year's reassessment vote, the department is ordering the Christmas Tree Marketing Board, of which Corliss is a member, to hold a second referendum in the coming year.
If we had lost by the same whisker, would we get another chance to have another referendum next year? The answer was no. I'm still boiling about that.
As in other ag sectors, the industry isn't helped by the fact that farmers are also aging out of the business. Corliss and his wife, now in their 80s, have just sold Piper Mountain to a couple in their 50s who live out of state and have no experience in tree farming. While Corliss says he fears for the future of tree farms such as his, unless the market shrinkage is stopped, he says there won't be room for the farmers in business now, let alone any new growth. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Jennifer Mitchell.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And from Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Friday, December 21st, 2018. Thanks to Ed Morin and our digital team. I'm Nora Flaherty.